Hi, Mika, and welcome to the show.
Hey, Randy, it's good to talk with you. Thanks for inviting me to the show.
Now, Mika, you're originally from Finland. What was it like growing up from a musical perspective?
Well, Finland has an ideal music education system. There is a music institute in every town, almost every town in Finland. I happened to go to a Waldorf pedagogy school, so even in my elementary school, music was emphasized a lot, and music was taught also on an individual level. Some people took violin, which I also did in the beginning, and then I found out that piano was really my thing. But before I started really studying piano, I went to the Helsinki Cathedral Boys Choir, Cantores Minores, which is actually very famous in Helsinki. I liked that a lot, and that also brought me to listen to and to get familiar with the music of Johann Sebastian Bach.
At what age did you decide to play the piano?
Piano really grew over time, because, as I said, I also studied violin, and but I didn't think that violin was enough. I wanted to play several notes at the same time, and I had played drums for half a year when I was seven, and I could never remember the tunes that I was playing. I always wanted to play tunes. So playing piano enabled me to do all of these things that I wanted to do. I wanted to hear harmony when I was playing, and I wanted to hear harmony when I was singing. In the choir I could hear that, but singing alone I could never hear that. So since I wanted to do it all myself, then piano really brought me into this. And I was around 8 years old when I really started studying it.
Did playing come naturally to you, or did you take any lessons?
First, it came naturally to me, but I started taking formal lessons from a friend of my father's. My father is also a professional musician. I started taking lessons around the age of 9, and then I got into the Vanta Music Institute outside of Helsinki. I was 10, and that was in 1982. I studied there for 5 years. That was an amazing place where to study. I owe them a lot. I had a beautiful piano teacher who taught me not only to be self-critical and to listen to what I was playing, but also the most important classical repertory. I would say that that somehow lives with me even in jazz today. Also, my theory teacher was great. He gave me insights not only to music theory and all the nuts and bolts of that stuff, but also to composition. And he actually encouraged me to get into my own ideas about how to organize notes and how to put those together. And he gave me a couple composition lessons just outside of all the Music Institute activity.
Mika, please discuss your first performance as a professional.
Well, depends on how you count. If you mean the first performance when I was paid, or if that was the first one when I had felt like I was doing a jazz festival. But I remember one gig that I had. I was 11 years old, and my father, who plays guitar, we had a wedding gig. I don't remember much of that gig, except that I was reading a lot, and I was really working hard on getting all the notes right. I was able to sight read pretty well, and my father encouraged me to do this also, and to become spontaneous in music, and not always prepare everything so carefully as the Music Institute had told me to do, but also to get into just learning to play at the site. We played popular songs, and we played probably a wedding waltz, and my father was really good at counting the tempos, because I tended to do everything a little bit too fast. So I remember that he was always trying to be a little more laid back on that. But that's one memory. Then, of course, much later I played at a jazz festival. That was in 1992 or 3. And I thought that was like really exciting, because then I had made it to play with, say, more seasoned players, and I had done something that, you know, I was always thinking about, oh, I'd like to play at the jazz festival and or at the jazz club and, you know, that kind of things. That was in Finland also, but I already studied at Berkeley at that time. But that was exciting as well.
Do you remember the first jazz concert that you ever attended?
I do. I attended the Oscar Peterson concert in Helsinki at the Finlandia Hall in 1982 with my mother. I was 10 years old, and in that band he had Nils Henning Ørsted Pedersen on bass, Joe Pass on guitar, and Martin Drew on drums. I liked the concert a lot. I had heard Oscar Peterson on record already a couple years before that. Yeah, they played some tunes that I knew, some standards which I had seen the lead sheet of and couldn't really play, but I knew that they existed and I knew the names and didn't really know what they mean because they had an English title. But I was able to pronounce them somehow in my very cranky Finnish, Swedish, English, whatever, something like that. I mean, yeah, I grew up as a bilingual in Finland, as both Swedish and Finnish speaker.
You've been living in New York City for quite some time now. Now, from a musical standpoint, what does New York City mean to you?
It's almost a cliché to say that you either love it or you hate it, but I'd say that it's much more than that. You both love and hate it. I love it because it's my life. I have to be here. This is where not only my musical peers are, but also all my friends. I've been here for over 10 years now. So also my playing in town goes in periods. Sometimes I play a lot at jazz clubs. Sometimes I do much more, a lot of writing work, and I don't really always take the advantage of what this city has to offer, and in a way I feel ashamed of that. But on the other side, I still have to be here because I love the energy that this city has to give. So being a part of society just as a player is not everything about being in New York. Also, New York is even better when you can get out every once in a while. It's an important part that I can go to Finland and go to visit my family and also go to play there with some of the bands that I lead there. But New York really, really has this, it's sort of an exemplary place where to be. There is every kind of person represented here somehow. And the fact that they get to, they get along with each other so well, I think should function as some sort of example for the rest of the world.
In Scandinavia, you lead a children's group called Moomin Voices. Now, how did this group come about?
Well, we started in 2003, but that was after the CD with the same name had been produced, also called Moomin Voices. And these contain Tove Jansson's original songs from the Moomin fairy tale characters, Moomin trolls. The CD was released in Swedish, and but the band started singing the Finnish translations because Finnish is the national language. You can view Finnish and Swedish in Finland is almost the same way as, actually, it's a very fair comparison to English and French in Canada. But during the course of the Moomin is becoming more international, these fairy tale songs, which were also written by Tove Jansson and her composer partner Erna Tauro, these songs were almost forgotten. And when both of these passed away, I just wanted to do something which would bring back the authenticity of this music, and that's how Moomin Voices came about. And now that band has had actually quite a bit of success over there, and we play for about, I would say, something like 10-15 concerts a year. I've never played for so many children in a concert hall. I remember one concert in the northern city of Oulu in about a year ago. We had two performances there on two consecutive days with 800 kids each performance. 800! So you can imagine before you enter the hall how different the sound was on the stage than compared to what it usually sounds like in a jazz concert where you hear a lot of lower voices.
From a musical perspective, how does this group inspire your writing and performing?
Well, in this band I mainly work as an arranger and also and a little bit as a composer, and it's only because some of these tunes which Tove Jansson wrote the lyrics for were never composed, and her composer partner Arna Tauro, who of course was the first choice for writing these songs, she died before Tove Jansson. But in terms of developing the music from now on, it's pretty much a dead end in my opinion, because the stories are set. There are no more songs available. So I try to write new arrangements sometimes when I realize that that a particular song could be enriched somehow by another kind of perspective on it, or I try to take influence from children's music, because I think that there is something very genuine about children's music when it's not children's pop or mass marketed music, but something that is actually is playful and tries to appeal to children on authentic and with an honest integrity. So I try to take influence from that type of childlike mentality when writing any kind of music.
Does Helsinki have a rich musical environment?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in terms of its size, of course. It has an amazingly rich musical environment. Helsinki only has 500,000 people in the city and 1 million with suburbs. Well, population doesn't really mean much when it comes to the life of a city, but I just have to mention this because Finland is an extremely small country, and for its size, it makes quite a bit of noise in the world. And there is quite a bit of concentration in music in Helsinki related to that, but no, in a way, regarding to what its importance is on the European scene or in the world scene. There is an opera which runs on a fairly successful basis. But in terms of jazz, there are musicians who are very skillful, and there is a small scene. But of course, like in almost every scene, with the exception of New York, everybody knows each other. And in order to survive, you have to take a lot of influence from other places all the time. It's not a city that would grow its own jazz culture that way. Of course not, because, I mean, jazz is American music originally. But there is a pretty successful conservatory environment also in jazz and popular music. But of course, the main part of the scene is about classical music, the European tradition.
Aside from performing and composing, you also produce CDs.
Yes, I produce CDs. I think it started from the fact that I wanted to do everything myself. And also, I tend to be a little bit of an impatient person when it comes to waiting in line for record companies to release or not to release my CDs. So I never thought that, you know, I can wait for 5 years before a company puts it out or something like that. No, I wanted to do it now. So that way I became a producer. Also, since I had ever since I started working on Moomin Voices, and after that on the Christmas record Scandinavian Yuletide Voices, and now the latest one, A Lark in a Snowstorm, I did everything from the beginning, all the way to the arrangements and everything. So in a way, to produce it all the way to the end was a natural thing to do. Also, putting it out just myself was absolutely the thing that I thought that I didn't really have a choice. So I wanted to do things my way, and be sure that my ideas, with the help of some great friends of mine who have been helping me with ideas, that they are realized actually on these records. So producing suddenly crept in to the picture, being a writer and being a player and being a little bit of a conductor. So at the end, it all came together by also being a producer of the CDs.
While in Finland and Sweden, you studied classical music. Now, how important was it to you to acquire a solid classical musical foundation?
In the beginning of my studies, I didn't really know of any other kind of music to study. I lived in the myth for quite a while that jazz was not something you study. It was something that you just learn by listening and, you know, things like that. And in a way, that's still what I think. But I was able to do a lot more than that. So classical music was what I studied because I wanted to study and because I wanted to learn a lot. So of course it was very important. In terms of having a solid classical foundation, depends on how far you want to take the concept of solid. What is solid? What is enough to be solid? I would say that the most important thing for me has been to learn to both appreciate classical music in its own way and not try to say that I'll take this element into jazz or I'll take that, but to understand that music can be in many different ways. That's been very valuable. Also, I'm a big fan of quite a few different styles, but particularly Baroque and Impressionistic music. Claude Debussy has been my favorite composer for ages. I mean, ever since I started elementary school, Claude Debussy always had something that struck me a little more than other composers. Of course, that taste has developed into appreciating composers like Marcel Dupré and some organ composers from France. Olivier Messiaen, of course. Georges Ligeti. People talk about technique a lot. And I know that it's very important, and of course it is important, but it's been so overemphasized somehow that I wouldn't like to take it into discussion here, because I think that most other piano players will talk about it.
Who are some of your favorite classical composers?
I already mentioned some of them. Debussy, Messiaen, Ligeti. Other favorite composers. There are so many. I mean, Bach, what can you say? The whole music history has proved who those guys are. Brahms is amazing. I mean, all these adjectives I'm trying to put on them, great, amazing, they don't cover how important and how much enjoyment they can give. Mozart has something very natural and magic in his music, which I've learned to appreciate only actually very recently, like say 5 years or so. Scriabin is a very interesting composer. Alexander Scriabin, he was a little crazy also. I mean, we all know that he was sick in his mind. He has had to pay a high price for his the gift that he has given to people and for the generations of our time and and probably generations to come. But there are so many, and I like to listen to music in a way that to give me ideas of how life was at that time. Because every kind of music that I hear tells something not only about the composer personally, but also something about their time. And instead of reading a lot of history books or reading about those stupid kings or something that you have to learn about in school, I like to listen to music from different periods of time because they really express the mood of that time.
Now, you studied with Gary Burton and Herb Pomeroy while at Berkeley. What was the most important lesson that you learned from them?
Well, from Gary Burton, I learned a lot. First of all, I learned the fact that you have to play if you want to be able to play. So play all the time. That was a very important lesson. He didn't actually tell me anything. He didn't really tell me all that much. We played tunes, and it was his sense of presence that really caught me, because I had never played with anybody who had that type of sense of time and consciousness in his playing as he had. Everything was so clear to him. Herb was a different story. He brought, first of all, he made me appreciate the music of Duke Ellington a lot more than I had done before. And his line writing course was probably the best writing course I've taken. It really combined the counterpoint courses that I had taken with jazz harmony. And while that concept by itself was not unfamiliar to me before, it really brought a system to how to use that. There is something interesting I remember from Herb Pomeroy, which was a little bit outside of music. He was talking about the test of taking a test and the difficulty of taking a test. His quarter exams and midterm exams and final exams were always about music, but also about the process of taking a test. And he worked with students in terms of teaching them reality. And he usually introduced this by saying, after 3 weeks of classes, "As now we have all become friends." And then he would start with the grades. And then he would start putting the grades first, and then the names. And you can imagine the nervousness that the students had when he would have five names up there with A's and B's, and then there were only C's, D's, and F's left in the test, and your name was not up there yet. So that taught a lot, because he didn't take it seriously. So he taught us not to take it seriously by exposing everything completely, and not by talking about anything in private, but always talking about it in class. So that was a very interesting way of teaching.
Do you prefer performing in concert or composing music?
It's not really a question of concert playing, performing in concert, or composing music. It's really both. You have to do both. At least I have to do both. Because a concert gives a sense of now, a sense of immediate attention, concentration at the moment. And also listening to the other musicians, if I'm playing with other musicians, listening to them at the moment. Because everything can be different than you had expected, especially in jazz. When it comes to composing music, that's a way to, for me at least, to peacefully organize my ideas. This is a necessary part of being creative. Even if a performer is not a songwriter or a composer and doesn't really want to play his compositions, there are fewer and fewer of those. A lot of people write tunes these days. I would say that exercising your right to compose is very important. There are some who don't write anything at all because they are so overly critical about what they are writing. So they don't want to write anything. So it's good to let go of those kind of judgments and just write whatever comes into mind. Even if it's something very, very simple, something that may seem like it was already done by somebody else. You don't have to worry about those things while writing. You only worry about if it's somebody else's tune already when you are about to publish that tune. So the process of being creative, at least for yourself, is crucial for a musician. There is no way that could substitute the experience of a concert or experience of a performance to reach an audience. There are also some musicians who think that it's enough if they can play music for themselves. I know some. I had a teacher who was like that here in the US, and he's very famous, and he doesn't care if his music has no listeners at all. But I'm not that way.
Japan has always been a hotbed for jazz. Most jazz enthusiasts are quite knowledgeable about this great art form. Now, what was it like for you performing in Japan?
Yeah, Japan is an interesting place. I performed there twice, once in 1994 and once in 2002. The 2002 tour was really one that I thought was a lot of fun. That was with Yusuke Yamamoto. We had just completed the Sound of Village CD, which was done on an earlier tour in Finland the year or two before, released by Splash Records. I didn't really notice that the jazz audience was so much more knowledgeable about music or about than anywhere else. I think that a jazz audience is usually very knowledgeable anywhere where people want to listen to this kind of music. In Japan, I feel that there is a true appreciation for music. So that's probably what you mean by that they are knowledgeable. There is a true appreciation for this music. It seldom functions as background music. And a part of the reason for that could be that it's not homegrown. It's not a homegrown art form in Japan the way it is in the United States, where this has been a part of society and it's been a part of a club culture, just a bar culture, which I think is a very healthy phenomenon, that you know, jazz is a part of, dance music, or that it is dance music, actually, at its core.
Do you do a lot of teaching?
I do. I have some teaching activity at the moment, but it's not a lot. I have only one private student regularly. Then I have some people, there are some people who come to me every once in a while and take one or two lessons in a topic which they decide themselves, and I agree to and think that that may be something where I can help them, hopefully. I teach in Finland a 1 week music camp as a theory teacher and also as a piano improvisation instructor. Teaching is a lot of fun when the student studies hard and is inspired. And that's not always the case, but when it is, time just flies, and it's so much fun to teach. Actually, sometimes I wonder if I have the right to take the money from those students when I'm having at least as much fun as they have. I've also done quite a bit of lecturing. I used to do a lot in Sweden in the 90s. I've done a lot in Finland, of course, and I did a major artist residency at Berklee College of Music a month ago, which was a lot of fun. There were so many great students, and that environment which I had been a part of earlier, reminded to me how much fun it is to be in an academic environment when it's balanced with a performance and a professional environment. So that means, as the same way as we just talked about composing and performing, I think that teaching and the academic environment comes as a third element into this entirety of a music existence, if that's a term, a way to be active in music.
In the jazz world, who have been some of your main influences?
The same way as with classical composers, everybody who has his own voice and his own little story to tell, I appreciate that. Art Tatum, let's stay with piano players for now so that there is some sort of guideline who I could mention here. Art Tatum, Lenny Tristano, Paul Bley, Keith Jarrett, Earl Hines, Teddy Wilson. Did I already say Bud Powell? I hope I did. If not, of course he's at the front of the list. I like Errol Garner a lot. He's very underrated, and sometimes some people regard him as some sort of entertainment pianist. I mean, what is that all about? Music is entertainment. So if that's what they mean, then great. There are so many. When it comes to other musicians, I like Wes Montgomery a lot, Wayne Shorter. So, I mean, I like jazz, jazz, whatever it is. There are some directions in jazz which I'm not such a big fan of, smooth jazz. I don't like all of this European stuff that's going on. Depending on how genuine it is, there is some stuff that's really amazing. When you try to be really creative, mindset that, oh, now I want to be really creative, then you may run into problems because you're not looking at yourself really in a truthful way, but instead just thinking more about being creative or something rather than just being who you are.
If possible, please give some musical examples about the process that you go through when it comes to composing a piece of music.
Well, first of all, when I write a piece, it's always a little bit of an accident. But sometimes, why it's so hard to talk about it, I guess, and you can hear that I'm staggering here, is that every tune is so different. So sometimes I write a whole tune in 15 minutes and that's it. And then I'm happy with how it turned out. It's just a process like, wow, there it is. So what else do you need? Then maybe half a year later I have a different idea. Oh, there should be another part to this. Or actually here there should be a first ending that goes like this and repeats back to the beginning or some other place or, you know, so that it may evolve over time also. I'm not afraid of editing my tunes later. Sometimes we perform them for a year and then there is suddenly a new lead sheet coming out and a new version coming out, which is then the extended tune. Or sometimes I cut out some of the parts of a tune. There are some parts in compositions which I don't like to play anymore, just because I don't feel that they are a part of the tune. So the tunes live in a way, but rather than that they would be solid after the ink has dried on the paper. In a way it's healthy to let the ink dry for real and not to edit the tunes, because of course your ideas change and then you can write another tune instead about your new ideas. But sometimes I'm more concerned of that the pieces that I still perform are up to date. So those tunes that I still perform, they change over time. How the piece really comes about, it may be anything, but it usually is something that I see or hear or experience. And it's not necessarily a deep internal experience. It could be something that I hear on the street that I think is peculiar or very interesting, or maybe something that somebody says which I think is funny. And the title of the tune may have nothing to do with what that person said or what I thought was funny. It's just a way to concentrate on a particular musical idea. So I concentrate on anything. It could be a building, it could be a person, it could be anything imaginable. There's this tune called Screenplay, which I wrote 5 years ago, which has a lot of changing meters in it. But I didn't really think about it. It was just a melody that I thought, oh, this is how it should go. And then when I actually wrote it on a clean piece of paper, so to say, then I realized how hard it would be to play. But I thought, well, that's what we have to take. What can you do?
The internet has changed the way musicians interact with their fans. Now, what impact has the internet had on your musical life?
The internet has had a huge impact. And in fact, if there is one musician who says that the internet hasn't had any impact on his life, he must live in some sort of strange bubble, because the internet has had an amazing impact on all musicians, and I think all people in general, how they communicate and how they can market their music. Just the fact that an independent musician can today release music without printing CDs, very expensive CDs, in large quantities, is an amazing asset. Digital downloads have had a big impact on me, and I was really impressed when I found out what those digital download retailers were about, that you could buy one tune instead of a whole CD. And I think that this gives so many possibilities for independent artists to sell their music, because there may be only 300 people or maybe 50 people who want to buy this tune, but those 50 people have the right to buy the tune. So with CDs, or especially with old-time LPs, this would by no way be possible. So it gives a lot of artistic freedom to create so-called crazy ideas, which I haven't really started with yet, but I will, I promise. I will do a lot of stuff at some point which I may not see an immediate market for. Because the risks are so small now, you can do a lot of stuff yourself with your peers, you know, a lot of ideas, layer music. It's not just about the internet, but also about music technology. The studio has come to the musician instead of the musician going to the studio. So today you can really make your music at home. In fact, we were joking with some musicians that we would never have to leave home anymore for anything. We would just have to order food before we get the USB plug into our blood veins, where we would get all the nutrition straight. We can always order food from the corner deli, and we can just make our music indoors, and then we can have the air conditioner, which produces the perfect summer weather or winter weather or whatever, right here indoors in this one place. Well, I'm not trying to create a Matrix kind of environment, but you know, when it comes to the life of a musician today, the internet and technology has given a lot of freedom to do things that may not appeal to so many people. And for those who are interested in hearing my music more in detail, they can go to my site at scandinavianmusic.net, www.scandinavianmusic.net, where you can hear a lot of samples from all my records. In fact, you can hear a little bit from every tune. Earlier, all of us musicians were dependent on record companies, which were the internet of that time, meaning they were the media outlet, how to find yourself into the world. Today, they still have a lot to say because they have more money than the independent musicians, but at the same time, their power has been diminished. I think that it's mainly a good thing, and it's most of all a fact that this is where we are, and both musicians and the middlemen and distributors and everybody, we just have to live with it, that this is the new way of the way the music business has organized itself.
Is there any one concert that you have seen in your life that totally blew you away?
Oh, yeah. I have seen some concerts which have totally blown me away. Let me mention a couple. At Harvard in Cambridge, in 1993, the Bulgarian Women's Choir. That was before I had ever heard them or ever heard of them. Another time was more of a predictable concert. That was Ravi Shankar's farewell concert at Carnegie Hall a few years ago. I can't say that it was a less of an experience, of course not. I mean, it was amazing. Jazz experiences, I've seen Wayne Shorter at the Stockholm Jazz Festival. That was something a few years ago.
Are there any other non-musical influences that impact your composing and performing?
Oh, yeah. Of course. Well, being alive, first of all, is a source of inspiration by itself. Of course, most of my influences in music are non-musical. And it's also because it's so much easier to concentrate on music when you're not concentrating first on somebody else's music, which you should be influenced by. But actually, you have an idea which is extra musical. So when it comes from somewhere else, then you take it into, sort of convert it into a musical idea. It's so much easier to be inspired and to be concentrated on that idea that was not a non-musical idea, and then write a tune, or to play something, play in a solo which is about some feeling, some particular sight, some place, how it felt at a particular moment, rather than going after some other musician or some other musical style, especially, which I think is, that has always been hard for me to play in a particular style. I've never really succeeded on that very well, and I don't think I will ever succeed very well. I've tried sometimes just as a sport to play really good bebop. But I always thought I somehow failed, because there were always ideas there which are a little bit outside of that realm of how I understand it, or, you know, that box which I understand, where I understand the limits are. Well, you know, and on the other side, there are no limits really to any genre. So all those feelings about where the genre limits are personal. But so that tells me that when I try to concentrate on a particular style of music, then I fail. So thinking about anything non-musical is so much easier.
Is there anyone that you have always dreamed of performing with or making a recording with?
Dreamed of? In terms of night dream, no, not really. In terms of daydreaming, yeah, I have, with Drew Gress and Mark Ferber, and we actually already did it, but only in my apartment. And the only reason why we haven't done it is because I haven't taken the initiative of making that recording true, and to make that happen. That's pretty much what I would have to do. Just to realize that project. I'm not really a dreamer in this way. I wish I could do play with that person. I'm happy with who I play with. I don't need to play with famous people or those, because I'm not even sure that those who are recognized as famous people, that they would do such a better job than those who actually play my music right now. Playing with people like Ben Mondor, Miguel Zenon, Rigmor Gustafsson, the singer from Sweden, and Fernando Ergo, bass player from Argentina, I think that in a way I don't need to dream, and that's a huge privilege.
Having listened to jazz from other cultures, I'm always awestruck by how they incorporate their folkloric music into the jazz element, giving it a unique richness and beauty.
As I mentioned, Fernando Huergo, he is a good example of this. He has, first of all, he's the first bass player who has really developed the chacarera tradition on the electric bass. This music is mainly based on bombo, guitar, and singing. And he has brought the drum and a bass note, you know, the bass lower frequency, into one element in the chacarera tradition. And he has made that a style in jazz. And playing in Fernando's band is really exciting because he doesn't only write tunes, but actually he's developing a whole genre right there. And there are people who are also doing that at the same time here in New York. There are some other, Fernando lives in Boston, but there are some people who do it here in New York. Drummer Franco Pina, who also plays with Fernando, they are doing it a lot together, and Franco plays with some other bands. There are some people here in New York who are playing Argentinian folkloric music, but in jazz. Some people have more folkloric elements than others. Some people have said that my music sounds Finnish. I don't know what that really means, but if they say so, I'm sure they are right. I've never thought about folk music that way, that it would be a part of my music, but I'm really happy to see how folk music has an influence on jazz, because there is a genuine feel and a part of that music that has grown for such a long time. It's almost like becoming fossil fuel to the music. It has time to grow, and then when it's imported into this aesthetics of improvised music of the moment, then it becomes really something good. So in a way, I think that folk music is a necessary part of jazz, because jazz is folk music at its core. It's African-American folk music. So in a way that this has then been licensed to the world as a form of creativity, in order to stay genuine, it needs folk music from different parts of the world so that it can be a genuine form of creativity in that part of the world. Otherwise, I think that it will die and it won't stay fresh the same way as it is if folk music is incorporated.
What kind of piano do you like to perform with?
I'm always a little surprised, let's say that way, when somebody prefers a different piano than Steinway. And while I'm not any sort of fan of any monopolies of any kind, unfortunately, Steinway is pretty much the king of the piano. There is very little to do about it right now. And it's not because I'm a Steinway artist that I'm saying this, although in a way, that way I'm biased. So saying that I like to play on a Steinway, of course I, in a way, you know, as a Steinway artist, I'm supposed to say that. But that's not really why I'm saying that. I've always been more excited to play a concert when I find a Steinway on stage. Yamaha is good. Yamaha is a piano that's often worth the money. But when it comes to really expressive instruments, and now we're not talking about what's worth the money or anything like that, but when we're just talking about the product itself, there is very little that rivals the Steinway piano. And I like both New York Steinways, both Astoria-style Steinways, you know, they're from New York Steinways, and also Hamburg Steinways. They're both good. They sound different, but I wouldn't separate between, say, like, this is good for jazz, this is good for pop, this is good for classical music. I've heard that kind of arguments. When you play the piano, you play the piano. You don't play a particular kind of piano. I've heard that sometimes I'm introduced as, you know, this guy plays the jazz piano. And I wonder, and I always ask, and what kind of instrument is that? No, I play the piano, and I like to play a Steinway. And I like to play any kind of piano that is in tune, of course. And I even play electric instruments sometimes, because they produce music as well. But of course, I have to say that I play the piano the best. And one more credit to Steinway, I play better when I play on a Steinway. Yeah, I mean, and without making that an infomercial, I think that most musicians would agree on that.
Mika, talk a little bit about A Lark in a Snowstorm. Tell us what the concept is behind that and what that is all about.
Leivonen lumimyrskyssä is the name in Finnish. A Lark in a Snowstorm is the English title, celebrating the music of Toivo Kärki. Toivo Kärki is or was a Finnish popular music writer, sort of Irving Berlin or Richard Rogers of Finland, who wrote a lot of popular music, over 1,400 pieces recorded, probably the most influential writer of Finnish tango ever. His music was also based on a jazz interest that he had and that grew on him from very early age. And I think it shines somehow through in his music. So he died in 1992, and when he would have turned 90, which was last year in 2005, I wanted to celebrate his music with new versions. And something that these Irving Berlin and Richard Rogers and Cole Porter type of composers have undergone is several jazz versions. But Toivo Kärki has not really been done in that fashion. So you can imagine, if you saw a bunch of Broadway shows and then nobody had ever done those to jazz, of course the temptation is very high, especially when knowing that in this American equivalent music, it has been done. So here we go. I had an amazing opportunity to work new arrangements completely from my own perspective without dismissing any of the original ideas and, you know, trying to stay with the original grooves of tango. And there is a Finnish folkloric rhythm called jenkka, which is a two-beat rhythm, which I tried to create also to different meters on the track, A Bit Melancholic, for instance, track number 10 on the record. And there is a part which goes in 5, and I try to really blur it so that you won't feel that it changes meters. It's just supposed to sound like that, you know, just I'm trying to incorporate it into the music so in a seamless way.
Minä muistan sen vielä kuin eilisen päivän, kun sä läksin minä kulkemaan. Ja se päivä se nostatti pilvien häivän mun mamma vanhan maailmaan. Sinä poikani muista on maailma julma ja pistävä sen joka kulma. Ja kun heilutti mun vähän valkeaa lina, niin se oli hiukan haikeaa. Sinut tyttö mä muistan kuin varttuvan kukan ensi kerran kun mä rakastuin. Ja sun katseesi kylmän kun mun poikan rukan ajoit kulkemaan mä naurusuin. Joka kulkijan maljasta hiukankin joisi se liikaa jos siemaista voisi. Ja kun näin oli kulkurin lempi niin halpa niin se oli hiukan haikeaa. Sinä mamma saa matkani, määrä sinun liinasi mä muistan hain. Yhä jatkan mä tietäni pitkä ja väärä, vaikka hiukkasenkin on nahtain. Silimaailmatie ei oo kaikille suotu ja kulkijaks on minut luotu. Ja kun maailma laitaa mun matkani lakkaa, niin se oli hiukan haikeaa. Vielä kun eilisen päivän kohta läksin minä kulkemaan. Ja se päivä se nostatti pilvien häivän mun mamma vanha maailmaan. Sinä poikani muista on maailma julma ja pistävä sen joka kulma. Ja kun heilutti mulle hän valkea liina, niin se oli hiukan haikeaa.
The whole idea started from this idea of making a tribute to Finnish popular music. And then I met the son of Toivo Kärki by an accident through the camp, music camp where I'm teaching every summer, because he happened to live in the same town. And at that time I already had an idea of writing arrangements of Toivo Kärki's music. But I hadn't really thought about how to go about it. Because of those 1,400 songs, I would have had quite a bit of work to do before choosing the right ones. So his son, who was an expert on his dad's music, he helped me a lot with finding the right tunes, and I was describing what kind of music I was looking for and what the aesthetics of the CD would be like, and that I wanted to do not his most popular songs or not his most his most neglected songs, but actually the best songs that we could find. And as much as the concept of what is the best song is subjective, we were able to come to terms on what is really some of the more valuable music that he has done. So he gave me 60 or so tracks to listen to. And I picked first 10 from there, and then we complemented those with 5 more together. And the title track, A Lark in a Snowstorm, is a tune that was never released before. There are still about 300 songs by Toivo Kärki which have never been released before. So this has been somewhat of a success in Finland since then. But what actually has given me more of a kick is that now, internationally, people are getting to know who Toivo Kärki actually was and what he did, because his music is virtually unknown outside of Finland. And I think that's a shame. More people should know about him.
Mika, thank you so much for taking the time to do this interview.
Thank you for having me, Randy. It was good to talk with you.